with the first jewel claim.
Collins, a photo of the Derby! Missed again!
The race for the Triple Crown erupts into an epic party. The Preakness Stakes, May 18th on NBC and Peacock.
Sunday, May 26th, the greatest spectacle in racing returns. The Indianapolis 500 on NBC and Peacock. 33 of the world's fastest drivers go head-to-head for a chance to kiss the bricks, taste the milk, and claim their place in racing history. Experience the drama, the pageantry, the tradition. Live from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, the Indy 500. Sunday, May 26th on NBC and Peacock. Or listen on Sirius XM NBC Sports Channel.
All right, welcome to Bet the Edge. I'm Jay Croucher here with Drew Dinsick and Trevor Sickamore, our guest today of PFF, co-host of the NFL Stock Exchange, with our very own Connor Rogers, my good friend who, Trevor, frankly, I see far too much of during football season, doing a show with him 5 days a week. I know you know that pain as well, but very happy to have you on, and we'll dive into everything around the draft, but wanted to get your thoughts first on Stephon Diggs, who obviously has left Buffalo, and just whether you think that, you know, how likely you think it is that the Bills take a receiver with their first pick, which right now they're minus 240 to draft a receiver first overall at 28th.
Yeah, I mean, look, they had a wide receiver need before they traded Stephon Diggs, right? I mean, with Gabe Davis out, we figured that, okay, well, Khalil Shakir is a nice wide receiver three. You obviously got Dalton Kincaid and Dawson Knox throw that receiver rotation. But other than that, it's, you know, it's Matt Collins, it's Justin Shorter. Now they signed Curtis Samuel, but those are kind of depth receivers anyway. So they were already looking for a wide receiver two, and now they're looking for a wide receiver one. So it's hard to look at their situation and not think that it's going to be one in, one out. Now, normally teams don't operate like that, right? I don't think the teams just trade away a good asset just to draft one. There's just not a lot of opportunities where that makes a lot of sense, especially for a team like Buffalo. But I will say that free agency is often the purpose of it is to supplement a lot of your needs so that you can draft best player available. You don't feel like you have to be pigeonholed into a certain position. Unfortunately, it kind of feels like the Bills are pigeonholed into a certain situation. Now, unless they totally think that their winning window is completely closed that we've seen over the last couple of years and that they are rebuilding over the next 2 years, it's hard for them to not look at this situation at 28 and think, okay, we got to take a receiver here. Now, the issue is, sure, it's a deep wide receiver class, but I mean, in order for you to get one of the guys that you really wanted, you know, Marvin Harrison Jr., Romo Odunze, and Malik Nabers, one of those guys, wherever they were falling, you got to get around the top 10, end of the top 10. That'd be a Julio Jones type of trade, you know, multiple first round picks, some day two picks. And I just think they're not going to, I don't really think they're going to do that. So instead, I look more towards like Brian Thomas Jr. from LSU, A.D. Mitchell from Texas, monitoring how they fall down the board, where they might be. And I could see a mini trade up from the Bills at 28 because it is kind of hard to believe that even one of those two receivers there would make it to them at 28. So it's getting more difficult for that to be the case. And so I think that, sure, you're going to see Buffalo get a little bit aggressive, maybe not as aggressive as people believed with them going to the top 10. But I think that wide receiver has still got to be the main option for them.
Yeah, I'm glad you threw a little cold water on some of the stuff people were floating of. Well, they got these assets. They can now get up to this number and get this. I honestly, like, they have so many team needs. And honestly, the defense really kind of needs an injection of youth on at all three levels. I wouldn't actually be surprised if their strategy isn't trade down. You can probably, you know, just take a bunch of swings on guys in the mid ranges as far as skill position groups. You're not going to get a wide receiver one, but, you know, you've already made your bet that Josh Allen is good enough to elevate the performance of a lot of wide receivers. If you were in their seats, I mean, would you basically, you know, treat this as an opportunity to rebuild considering sort of the landscape of the AFC and what you have talent-wise on this roster?
I think so, right? I mean, you looked at Buffalo and it did. It felt like their chips were on the table, if you will, or the cards were on the table, whatever kind of, you know, Texas Hold'em analogy that you want to put out there. Like over the last 3 or 4 years, like this was kind of their time to win a Super Bowl and they didn't. And it's unfortunate because, you know, you get the overtime rules 1 year and it's just like the ball bounces the wrong way these other 2 years and it stinks. But, you know, now you're Tre'Davious White's no longer there. Jermaine Edmonds, obviously not there from the year before. Von Miller's not nearly as effective as he once was, and he's probably on his last year in Buffalo. Micah Hyde, Jordan Poyer, they're out of there as well. Mitch Morris no longer there. Stephon Diggs no longer there. And so it's like, man, that regime, that identity of the team that was in that winning window is now gone. So you figured that that is going to be the case. They're going to be in a little bit of a rebuild, and it's hard to stomach that when you have a quarterback who is of MVP caliber. You always want to have your foot on the gas, and sure, they want to be competitive. But if I was Buffalo, especially thinking about the dead cap hit that the Bills are taking on to trade Stephon Diggs, it feels like there's more of a long-term plan here than necessarily keeping their foot on the gas. Like if the rest of their roster was solidified and they just needed a wide receiver one, maybe you do conjure up a Julio Jones type of a trade and you go for it, you know, here. But I just, you mentioned it with the holes that they have on their roster. I just cannot see that being the smartest use of their assets for where they currently are.
Yeah, I think as someone who would bet fairly aggressively on the Bills to win the Super Bowl this year, I will always remember and walk with a limp from those three deep balls in the game against Kansas City that went to Diggs and Sherfield, where I think if they just come down with any one of those, they're certainly in the AFC title game against the Baltimore team that, at least in that one matchup against Kansas City, revealed some flaws. But now they're the Bills, who have been, I mean, they're still the favorite to win the AFC East, but you'd certainly be taking the field against them. And between all the upside that Miami and the Jets have, suspect that one of them may get Buffalo in this diminished state. Trevor, let's talk about JJ McCarthy, who I think is kind of the hinge point of the draft, the inflection point at which everything kind of turns.
Yeah.
And in a Will Levis-y type of way, though it certainly seems that JJ's floor is higher than Levis. Be pretty stunned at this point if JJ falls out of certainly the first round as Will Levis did. But what do you think is his realistic ceiling and floor in the draft?
That's a good question. I don't think that we're in like Will Levis parallels here. I really don't. I genuinely believe that the NFL really likes JJ McCarthy. And the Levis stuff was just so wildfire last year, right? I mean, remember, like, 48 hours out from draft night, his odds skyrocketed to go 2 overall. And we were like, whoa, okay, well, Vegas isn't trying to lose money, so there must be some smoke here with this fire. And there obviously wasn't. Now, I will say this, like, there was at least one team that was picking within that top 10 that thought long and hard about Will Levis. So it's not like he was just always like, no question about it, was never going to be in that position. But as we know from the NFL draft, like, it only takes one team, it only takes one decision, and now the guy's sliding all the way out of the first round. Now, that was kind of an egregious example. But, you know, when you look at J.J. McCarthy, I think his floor and his ceiling, I think it's a great question. It's a great way to pose it. I think number two is the ceiling. I really do. Like, I think that there is a world that could exist where he would go number two overall. Now, do I think it's the most likely? No. I think what's most likely is him going either 4 or 5 to whoever's going to trade up with Arizona or the Los Angeles Chargers, you know, whether that be the Minnesota Vikings, the Denver Broncos, the Las Vegas Raiders, or even maybe the New York Giants, because those teams don't have to drop too far and they can go get a JJ McCarthy if he's still on the board. So the ceiling to me is number two at Washington. The most likely is 4 or 5 with whoever the Chargers and the Cardinals are going to trade back with. And then I think the floor is certainly 11, 12, 13, you know, one of those teams that are right there. Like, there's no way he would ever get past one of those teams. They would take him no matter what. So that's kind of where I feel like his range is.
Yeah. JJ McCarthy's pretty interesting. He's obviously, you know, he's a prospect that is going to require some development. And I feel like his floor and ceiling of like impact as a player is probably as wide as his floor and ceiling of where he gets drafted. Because, you know, in the right situation, this is a guy that you could see develop into, you know, something really special if he has weapons to throw to and, you know, a good scheme and system, which is what, you know, Minnesota looks like. But if he ends up on like the Patriots, is that like the easiest thing to sell of all time? Yes, I think that's probably going to be a disaster. And so, you know, he is pretty fascinating. Do you have a general sense on what's going on with the number two pick right now? Because there's been whether you know, for the listeners, if you haven't been following closely, there's only a couple places you can get serious big boy liquidity into these markets, and there's been a war going on where people believe pretty sincerely that this is Daniels, and other people are putting their reputation online that it's going to be May. So do you have a dog in this fight?
It feels like Daniels. Now, I don't have a dog. Like, I'm not going to sit here and, you know, pound my chest and tell you that this guy's going number two overall. I will tell you that if I was making the pick, you know, without interviewing these guys, because we know interviews mean a lot, but just from watching the tape, I'd take May. Like, I'd take May and I wouldn't think twice about it. Like, Drake May to me is very easily QB2 in this class behind Caleb Williams. So I would be taking Drake May just from film and production alone of what I've seen over the last 2 years. Now, obviously, Daniels had the best 2023 of any of these quarterbacks. But, you know, when you combine the last 2 years, you combine what May did as a sophomore, nobody's thrown more big time throws in all of college football than Drake May. And I don't really know how we're starting to have these conversations. It feels like we're very much nitpicking Drake May and letting some of these other non-perfect prospects, just some of their flaws coast. And the standard feels very different for May versus the rest of the quarterbacks in this class. So I'd be taking May 2 overall, but it certainly seems like Daniels is getting the edge right now to be the quarterback to play with Cliff Kingsbury in that offense as the offensive coordinator there. You'll obviously be able to use a spread offense with him that he was able to do at LSU, and a vertical offense like Cliff Kingsbury likes to do, you know, those shorter shots to bring up the big, the vertical throws, and obviously have some of an RPO threat to him as well with that rushing ability. So it seems like that's where we're going with him being the favorite to go number two.
Yeah, it's a weird one because everyone I speak to as well is like, why is Drake May just not going two? The last time I remember something like this in cross sport, but when Luka Doncic went three in the draft and everyone was like, no, Luka Doncic is the best player in the draft. But yeah, he's just going to go three behind DeAndre Ayton and Marvin Bagley. But speaking, Trevor, to Connor the other day, he was pretty confident that, you know, we're going to get four quarterbacks in the first five picks. That's the likely outcome. And then the fifth guy in those top five picks is very likely Marvin Harrison Jr. Now, whether that's at four or five, we'll see. How do you think this ultimately shakes out with the wide receivers? Do you think that Marvin Harrison Jr. does just go four or five and then the Giants likely take Malik Nabers at six?
It's very difficult for me to predict a world where Marvin Harrison Jr. is not a top five pick, right? Even with all the quarterback craze that we have, you could put four quarterbacks in that list if you want. Pick number five is going to be Harrison Jr. Like, there's just it's so hard for me to think that it would not be. The only world where that could exist is a slim but not impossible, you know, scenario where Caleb goes one, let's say Drake May goes two, Jaden goes three, or you could flip those guys, it doesn't matter. Minnesota trades up with the Arizona Cardinals at number four. Minnesota takes McCarthy at four. And then the Chargers, because Jim Harbaugh likes offensive line a lot, maybe he'll draft, you know, Joe Alt at five. You know, and that's the only scenario where it makes sense. But even then, that would require Harbaugh and Jim Ortiz, the new general manager there, to stare Marvin Harrison Jr. in the face and tell him, no, we're going to pick somebody else. And I just think that's a lot easier said than it is done. So that's kind of how I see it shaking out. And look, I really don't know exactly what's going to happen after that, because if you ask most people, they would tell you that consensus-wise, Malik Nabers would be off the board no matter what next. But, you know, one of those teams that's picking very high in the draft is the New York Giants at six. I think the Giants would love Romo Odunze. You know, he gives them an archetype and a size-speed combination of a player who can play on the line of scrimmage that they don't have right now. The Malik Nabers, obviously a incredible talent, but they have a lot of speed on their roster already. If they want something different, if they want a bigger-bodied receiver, they're going to go with Odunze. So there is still a world where, yes, I think that the debate between wide receiver one is much more between Malik Nabers and Marvin Harrison Jr. than it is with Romo Odunze in the mix. But that doesn't mean that Odunze is much less of a chance to be the second receiver taken. I think that it just kind of depends on the team and how they see him. This really is, if you ask me, a big three of wide receivers in this draft that could really go anywhere in the top 10.
If the Chargers pass on Marvin Harrison Jr. with the fifth pick and he's sitting there, I think we've got the earliest ever indication of a failed regime that I can can remember. That would be just absolutely inexcusable, considering what, you know, magic that would be for the rest of the, you know, Herbert career there. So can't fathom it. Let's see what happens ultimately. But staying on wide receivers, this is a very talented class. And this is now several years in a row where we've had really, really talented wide receiver classes. This one is probably a clear class above last year's, which was great. And, you know, we're 2 years removed from, you know, super elite classes. The weird trend, however, is that you've seen a lot of these guys who would otherwise be round one talent grade slide into the, you know, early part of round two. There seems to be less of a kind of need to have a fifth year option on a guy. And maybe it's just the surplus of young wide receivers that have come into league that's kind of begetting this. But we're looking at a number right now, total over under of 6.5 wide receivers taken. The under has been bet. It's down to -155. The over is +125. This feels right to me, but I can make a case for the under. Do you have an opinion one way or the other, whether we're going to see 7 or 6 wide receivers going round one?
Yeah, that's, I mean, the number's spot on, right? Because Malik Nabers, Rome Odunze, Marvin Harrison Jr., Brian Thomas Jr., A.D. Mitchell. Like, I think that they're first round locks. I really do. I'd be shocked if any of those guys get out of the first round. Then you have the serious wild card of Xavier Worthy, who I don't think has first round tape. Like, I don't think he's a first round wide receiver, but he's the fastest man the combine has ever seen. So what do you do with that information, right? I mean, this is a league that made John Ross a top 10 overall pick just because of how he was able to run. And I think Xavier Worthy is a better football player than John Ross is, but is the league going to, as a whole, look at this and say, we're not going to make that same mistake again? But even that, you know, making the same mistake again, okay, so you're not taking Xavier Worthy in the top 10. You're taking him at, I don't know, 29, 30, 32, whatever it is. So that's where I think it gets really tricky for me is I don't know how much of a guarantee it is that Worthy makes it into the first round. He basically holds the key because after that, Keon Coleman, Ladd McConkey, Ricky Pearsall, Roman Wilson, Troy Franklin, all of those guys could be candidates to be back into the first round players. But if we're getting any of those guys in, I think we're only getting one. So whether or not you hit over 6.5 is whether or not you believe that Xavier Worthy is going to go in the first round. Do you think the NFL cannot help themselves and will take him in the first round because of his speed? Because if you do, then I would tell you, bet the over. Just bet the over because you'd be more confident in it. But if you don't think that Xavier Worthy is going to make it, then I think there's a legit chance that 6 is the magic number there, which makes 6.5 a really good line. I'm
ready to go. Streaming now only on Peacock. 5 rich and famous international soccer stars. They have everything except love.
I think girls in the past have gone for me because of what I've got.
That's why we're going undercover.
We're setting them up with single American women.
They don't know we are famous. They don't know we are rich.
And they'll have to hide their true identity.
Oh, what do you need for work?
I'm an ad salesman.
Oh, God. What am I doing?
Love Undercover. New series streaming now only on Peacock.
The Premier League is built on hope. The hope of discovering a new star.
It doesn't take long.
The hope of rewriting history. And the hope of continuing a dynasty.
Unstoppable week after week.
This is the Premier League on NBC, USA, and Peacock.
For the world's greatest athletes,
this is the showdown we've been waiting for.
There is nothing like competing on the world's biggest stage.
It's a world record!
And when that stage is Paris, anything can happen.
I have never seen anything like this.
How about that?
An Olympics unlike any other.
What a performance!
The Paris Olympics. Friday, July 26th on NBC and Peacock.
Okay. No, I think that makes a lot of sense. Let's pivot to offensive line and the Titans, who had maybe the weirdest offseason of anyone, or in the midst of the weirdest offseason. This team just kind of randomly has L'Jarius Sneed, Calvin Ridley, and Tony Pollard on it now. And everyone thought that they might be in a rebuilding phase, but they seem to be trying to kickstart that. Now, Joe Alt at 7 to the Titans, that seems like the surest fit in the top 10 outside of Caleb Williams to the Bears. Do you think there is a chance that the Titans spring a surprise here, or is Alt their guy if he's there?
It would be so hard for them to, like, the scenario that we put up before. If the Chargers look Marvin Harrison Jr. in the eye and say, now we're going to take somebody else, it would be equally as difficult to believe that the Titans and how bad their offensive line is to look at Joe Alt and take somebody else. Like, I guess if they took a different offensive lineman, like if they love Troy Faltanu from Washington or Talise Fuanga from Oregon State or Olu Fashanu from Penn State, you know, maybe one of those guys, but I feel like Joe Alt's just a better player. So it's hard for me to make a case over any of those guys to be the pick over Joe Alt. But to me, it just has to be offensive line no matter what. And the reason why I would kind of take Faltanu off the board for them is, okay, you kind of drafted that guy already with Peter Skoronski last year, and you just moved him immediately inside. Now, I know that was, you know, another coaching regime, and so things could be a little bit different with their outlook and flexibility. But to answer your question, there's a reason why I think he is the big favorite to go at seven to the Titans, because the Titans have made a lot of noise since the new league year turned around and they were able to open up free agency. They brought in a lot of nice pieces. They've traded for L'Jarius Sneed. They've signed Calvin Ridley. There's a handful of other players that they brought in, but offensive line largely has been the same. You know, they bring in Lloyd Cushenberry, but they need more than just that. They need tackles. They need good players. And so Joe Alt absolutely fits that to a T.
Yeah, it's rare that you have a seventh overall pick with this high of confidence, but I feel the closer we get, this is just going to be consensus. Really, the only risk of it not happening is if the Chargers do something absurd. Same kind of concept or question for you here on the offensive line. This is a huge number. Over under for offensive linemen in the first round is 9.5. Some places 10.5. Like this is a very, very good class. And as you get to the back end of round one, everybody needs a guy. So it kind of makes sense that you're just going to see a huge number of these guys go off the board before day two. Do you have a general read if this is a 9.5 to the over, or if we should just find another way into this, like offensive players, and just combine offensive line and wide receiver and say, look, like such a rich class across these two, let's just go offense. What's your general read there?
Yeah, so I'll list off the offensive tackles, or just the offensive linemen, I should say, overall, that I just think are locks for the first round. Joe Alt is one, Fuanga is two, Faltanu is three, Fashanu is four, Latham is five, Mims is six, Barton is seven. Okay. And I think those are the locks. I think we've got seven locks. Now, I think Jackson Powers Johnson certainly within that conversation as well, although I've heard some medicals with him, and this is all sort of rumors and nothing's really concrete, but I wondered, I'd heard the medicals maybe didn't come back as clean for some teams. So I wonder if he could fall down on the board a little bit. Tyler Guyton, I think he's going to be in the first round, but here's the thing. Like, he's still a 1 year starter who definitely needs to improve in his fundamentals and how he approaches the game. Like Guyton, I don't think Guyton is somebody that you want to throw out there in like year one. So are any of those teams that are really competing at the back end of the first round, like you mentioned, they need offensive linemen, are they going to be desperate to want to draft him and play him right away? Because I think that's a little bit dangerous. So that's why I think both of those guys are more likely than not to go in the first round, but I can actually see a world where they don't. So if you throw those two in, that gets us to 9. Okay. And then you've got, I think I would go under on the 9, because if those guys are toss-ups, Zach Frazier could go in the first round, the interior offensive lineman from West Virginia, but I think that would be – I don't know if that's going to happen. Jordan Morgan, I think teams like. He's definitely a back end of the first round candidate, but I think he's even less likely than the two players that I previously mentioned. Kingsley Suamatia from BYU – kind of in the same situation as Tyler Guyton. He would take a little bit of time to really develop and be a starter. So a lot of names that you could throw out there, but I've got 7 locks at offensive line to go in the first round. And then I've got tiers of the next two I'm pretty confident. The next two I'm sort of confident. The next one would be a stretch for me. So I'd actually probably be betting the under. I'd bet 9 is probably the safe one for me.
So either way, it's just going to be that. That's the sweat of round one of the draft. If you really just want to pour it out, because they're all going to go out. It's just going to get wild in the back half of round one with offensive line. So
yeah.
Okay. So I like it. Under 9.5 sounds good to me. It's plus money right now. So
there you go.
Last question for you, Trevor, on defense. Now Dallas Turner is -190 to be the first defensive player drafted, which always makes me nervous when we're this far out from the draft and a guy is -190 as opposed to, you get into the lock territory of -5,000, but he's not there. Do you think there is any chance for a surprise here and that someone could go over Turner on defense?
I certainly think that that's possible. I really do. I think that people are still kind of riding Turner's combine performance and how incredible it was. And they're just kind of sitting off of that as, yeah, he's absolutely going to be the first defensive tackle or sorry, just defensive player off the board, no matter what. But I genuinely like Quinyon Mitchell, the corner from Toledo, he's been incredible. And look, I mean, let's be honest. I think everybody's looking at the Falcons at 8, right? And they go, okay, what are the Falcons going to do? Because they're probably going to take defense. They spent a lot of money on the offensive side of the ball when it came to free agency. What are they going to do on defense? And to me, like, I'm just looking at the numbers that are on the screen here. Verse at 750 or Mitchell at 750 is the better bet than Turner to me. Like those numbers are way better to me because there is absolutely a world where even though the Falcons are moving more to a 3-4 and they're going to want outside linebacker rushers, you know, Turner fits that a little bit better. Like if they just like the power profile of Jared Verse, I mean, that's going to weigh more to them as getting the better player than Dallas Turner is. And then Quinyon Mitchell, man, you got to think about this too. The Falcons really, they don't really have a starting solidified CB2 that they're comfortable with outside of AJ Terrell. And even AJ Terrell is entering the last year of his contract. Sure, they're going to want to bring him back. But as we saw with the Calvin Ridley situation, Jags thought that they were always bringing Calvin Ridley back. That was a foregone conclusion. And then whoops, all of a sudden, boom, you let free agency come around. He's not under contract. And now he's playing for a division rival. So you just never know. And so I think that Mitchell as CB1 in this draft could absolutely be the choice for them at number 8 if they don't love one of the edge rushers or think that they could get a good one a little bit later in the draft. Now, again, like I understand why Turner is the favorite. I'm just a sucker for a good number on a bet, and I do feel as though Jared Verse and Quinyon Mitchell both sitting there at plus 700 if those are your odds feel a little bit better to me than thinking that Dallas Turner's like consensus close to where he was.
This is fantastic because my last question was going to be who's the biggest riser over the next couple weeks and why is it Mitchell? And so you just kind of gave it because he's, you know, he's clear CB1 of this draft and a lot of teams need cornerback help.
Right.
A better bet to take him 750 to the Falcons at the eighth pick or just first defensive player in like the plus 450 range?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of like because who else would need a defender, right?
Sure.
Like,
yeah.
Chicago's not drafting a defensive player, certainly not a secondary player. The Jets are certainly not drafting a secondary player. Minnesota could, but they're quarterback focused, so they're not going to do that. Denver maybe, like Denver, if Quinyon has not gone off the board and Denver's on the clock at 12, they don't have the opportunity to quarterback. You pair him with, you know, Patrick Surtain II, like that's a sick outside cornerback duo. So that might be tough to pass up. And then Las Vegas sitting there right there at 13, like they also major need for corner as well. So I think that he's kind of like right within that range, but it would require Turner. Yeah, it would require the Falcons to not pick him at 8. I think to answer your question though, like the guy that I think is actually going to rise the most is Cooper DeJean, the cornerback from Iowa. Like, I think we're all just forgetting how good he is because he was very, very good in 2022. Didn't play a lot in 2023 because he had the foot injury and wasn't able to work out at the combine. He's an incredible all-around athlete. Wasn't able to work out at Iowa's pro day. Now his pro day is like coming up. It's going to be one of the last pro days. It's like an individual pro day that he's going to do. And I think that when he goes on top 30 visits with these teams, when he's able to test at pro day, if he tests really well the way that I think that he is capable of doing, I think you're going to see him bump up into that conversation as like, okay, he's in the same tier as Quinyon Mitchell, as Terrion Arnold, as one of those guys. Now, I don't know if he's, you know, I don't know if a bet would be smart for him to be, you know, CB1 off the board. I think it's kind of too late in the process for him to have that kind of a jump, but in terms of like, if he ever has like an over under draft position, wherever it is right now, I feel like it's a little bit lower than where he's actually going to get picked. And I think we might see that with his pro day coming up. So he's the guy that I actually think could be rising up the board the most.
Okay. I'll give you a fake number because it's going to be like around 24 and a half.
Yeah. 24 and a half is the sweet spot, right? Because the Packers pick at 25. And I think he'd be a really good Green Bay Packer if they wanted to take him there. But, you know, even with that being said, Philly's at 22. Okay. The Steelers are at 20. The Colts are at 15. The Jags are at 17. Every single one of those teams would pick a cornerback. Like every single one of those teams he'd be on the board for. So if he, if you find him somewhere and he's, yeah, like 24 and a half lays the over under right now, like I bet the under. There's too many teams that need corners, and I think he's a really good one.
Okay. Certainly one to monitor. Well, Trevor, thank you very much for joining us. Thank you as well for your stunning camera quality. Look like a character in a David Fincher film. It really is magnificent. Everyone can follow Trevor at Tampa Bay Trey on Twitter. Anything to plug at the moment in terms of what you're working on? I imagine it's basically just everything.
Yeah, essentially. Yeah. PFF draft guide. And then me and your favorite person, Connor Rogers, just doing the NFL stock exchange over on YouTube. So you come hang out and listen to us talk draft prospects over there as well.
Okay. I love it. Thank you very much for your time, Trevor. And we'll speak to you soon.
Appreciate it, guys. Anytime.
Cheers. All right, Drew, cap off Premier League Fan Fest in Nashville this weekend by watching a thrilling matchup on Sunday as Mo Salah and Liverpool look to stay atop the standings as they take on Man United. Kickoff is set for 10:30 a.m. Eastern, only on NBC and Peacock.
For the world's greatest athletes,
this is the showdown we've been waiting for.
There is nothing like competing on the world's biggest stage.
It's a world record again! Goal for the United States!
And when that stage is Paris, anything can happen.
I have never seen anything like this.
How about that?
An Olympics unlike any other.
What a performance!
The Paris Olympics, this summer on NBC and streaming on Peacock. For the world's greatest athletes,
this is the showdown we've been waiting for.
There is nothing like competing on the world's biggest stage.
It's a world record again!
Gold for the United States!
And when that stage is Paris, anything can happen.
I have never seen anything like this.
How about that?
An Olympics unlike any other.
What a performance!
The Paris Olympics. Friday, July 26th on NBC and Peacock.
Dear listener, please close your eyes for this movie theater meditation brought to you by Fandango. Breathe in. Smell the fresh popcorn. Now exhale. Open your eyes and proceed to the best seats in the house you reserved on Fandango. Recline. Now, download the free Fandango app for movie times, tickets, and seats at your favorite theaters. Fandango. It's your ticket to the movies.
Thought Sheffield United might do me a solid.
Oh, they were so close. So close.
Liverpool were like minus 1,600 three-way money line favorites, and it was tied in the 75th minute. And then Alexis McAllister unfortunately had other ideas. That is going to be a painful sweat right to the finish. 30 games in, 8 to play. Liverpool 2 points clear at the top. Still don't know why Arsenal played for the draw at the Etihad. I think they needed a win there. Anyway, let's close out with some NBA thoughts. I have something I want to get off my chest about Sixth Man of the Year. But firstly, what are you monitoring this weekend?
Jay, whatever happens from here, yesterday was the biggest result of the season for me with the Orlando Magic taking down the Pelicans.
Imagine
that. That was a two-way, you know, couldn't have scripted it better. I feel bad for the Pelicans, but I need them continue to take some L's here. Pelicans, by the way, still have games at the Suns, at the Kings, at the Warriors, and home versus the Lakers in the final week of the season. What's common about those four teams, Jay? They're all trying to get out of the play-in. And so it is very, very interesting to see how that ultimately shakes out and what's like kind of key, at least for like what would really kind of have ripple effects in the futures market. We've assumed for months now that 9 and 10 are going to be Lakers-Warriors. And that's sort of like only one of those teams might get in to the playoffs. Well, now with the Pelicans finally kind of, you know, falling out of, you know, with winning form and with the Kings being injured, like I would say it is not entirely impossible for Lakers to get the 7, Warriors to get the 8, which would make the kind of overall, you know, teams available in the futures book, you know, you would have huge, huge shifts in win probability if that occurs, because people are not taking the Kings or the Pelicans as serious contenders. So, yeah, fascinating to see how that goes. A bet I made today, I've capitulated on the Nuggets winning the West and you know, winning the one seed in the West. I can't get there schedule-wise with what's left. With the Clippers basically pulling the rug today with Kawhi not going, very tough for me to see how the Clippers find a way. And you know, they feel like they're just trying to run out the clock here anyway. If the Nuggets win this game, then they really only have one more game on the schedule, which they are hosting the Timberwolves. That would be a potential loss. And in that world, they finish with the most wins because they would hang another loss on the on the Timberwolves. Timberwolves, by the way, have games at tough games at Suns and Lakers coming up, and I think potentially a couple more losses in addition to that game where they're going to be huge dogs to the Nuggets. So Nuggets -153. I pulled the plug. I hit it as hard as I could. I give up. This covers losses in the MVP market. This covers losses in the Northwest market. I just have fully capitulated. This is just going to happen.
Okay. I can't quite get there on the Nuggets. I understand I'm in a pretty good spot schedule-wise, but one sneaky thing with the Nuggets schedule, like home to Atlanta 3 weeks ago looked like a complete layup. Atlanta's actually playing like relatively well at the moment. And if we'll see what the status of Jamal Murray's knee is and whether he's actually going to play in these games, because that is a pretty big hinge point. Like if Jamal is out, like the Nuggets aren't that great. If Jamal Murray is out, like they very nearly lost to the Spurs. They very nearly lost to the Raptors somewhat recently in a game at home too. So we'll see. If Murray is back and they're healthy, then they really should get the one seed, but there is still some scope for weirdness. And that game against Minnesota on national television on Wednesday, April 10th, that looms very large. And that is a nice segue into sixth man of the year. We covered this market. We covered all the awards markets in great deal the other day. But I just wanted to say one thing about sixth man of the year, which we maybe didn't tackle when we talked about the market, is that Naz Reid, who is now minus money, he's now picked to win the award with Malik Monk. And I really don't know what is going to happen with this award. But one thing that a lot of people have brought up is that Naz Reid is now starting games. And that will hurt his candidacy, allegedly, that he's starting games because Emmanuel Quickley started games towards the end of last season. And I think that is a little bit of a fallacy, the idea that Naz is going to be disqualified by voters because he's starting these games. And the reason why I think that is wrong, both on merit, clearly, because it's just completely ridiculous to disqualify a candidate because they've stepped up in the absence of another player and helped elevate their team to keep them in the one seed race. So on merit, it's ridiculous. And then secondly, in terms of how it will resonate with voters, I think it's just different to Quickley. And this is very difficult to prove, but my theory is that if you weren't paying a lot of attention to the Knicks and sweating out Quickley sixth man of the year bets like I was all last March and April, the way that it happened with Quickley and his starts is that there was no like singular injury. Like Brunson would miss a few games with his ankle. RJ Barrett had like a concussion or something, and then Quickley would just fill in for either of them. Then Julius Randle hurt his knee or his shoulder. Yeah, I think it was his knee against Miami, and then Quickley starting for him. So it's just like all these random dudes just kept on missing games, and Quickley would just start whenever those guys would miss. And so if you weren't paying that much attention, you might have felt that Quickley's just the starter now. Like it's not like he's actually the sixth man, bench guy anymore. He's actually just been elevated to starter. And with Naz Reid, I feel like it's a little bit cleaner because there is such a clean point of delineation where he is only starting temporarily because Karl Towns tore his meniscus. And as soon as Towns comes back, Naz goes back to the bench. Naz is not the starter. He's not a full-time starter. He is just filling in for Towns. And Towns, according to Shams Charania, is going to come back before the end of the regular season. Naz will go back to the bench for the last couple of games and Quickley started 20 games total. Naz is going to start like 13. And so I don't think that Naz is going to be disqualified from the award because he put up bigger numbers in 13 starts, helping his team stay in the hunt for the one seed without Towns when he's come off the bench 68 times. And so I don't think that like Naz is going to, I don't think like Naz is like a lock for the award and he's going to storm home because people aren't going to disqualify him for the starts. I am much more worried as a Naz backer about the fact he's only averaging 13.4 points per game. That keeps me up at night a lot more than the fact that he's going to start 13 games. But what do you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know it's more problematic than being in the starting lineup for Naz Reid? Not playing for Malik Monk, because the Kings now go on a 4-game road stretch where they play the Knicks as dogs tonight. And I, speaking of, what are you paying attention to? Knicks, full heart perform, please give us a win here. Just give us a win. They got Knicks, they got Celtics, they got Thunder on this 4-game stretch. That looks like three losses. They're sliding, and they could really use Malik Monk. And you know what else is funny about that whole point you're making? Malik Monk should have started almost this whole year. He's a better player than Kevin Huerter.
I know. It's so stupid, the idea that one player can win over another because he happened to just come off the bench or he didn't spot start, even though he was playing the same amount of minutes. Like, what does that have anything to do with merit? So long as you're primarily coming off the bench, that should be the argument. And yeah. I think a good thing here for Naz is that, like, John Krasinski of The Athletic, God bless his soul, he wrote this article about why Naz starting should actually help his case. And the Wolves broadcast, which, you know, it's the Wolves broadcast, so whatever, it doesn't count for a lot, but they are pushing as well every Wolves game. Like, no, the fact that Naz is starting, that helps his case because it shows that he can scale up and fill in when required and help elevate the team. And that has always been part of the sixth man role. Like, Lamar Odom started 37 games the year he won the award. And so I think that the fact that he's starting, I think it may actually, I mean, ideally he'd still be coming off the bench and it would just be super clean to see 81 games off the bench, none starting. But I still think that it's not going to hurt him. I think the bigger issue is that Monk was very entrenched as the lead guy and Naz's points per game don't stack up. But, you know, everything else stacks up. He's on a team that, as we speak, in the one seed, and the Kings are in the eighth seed. And as is like efficiency of shooting splits. The other thing too with six man is that did he lose because he's made 20 starts? Is that definitely the reason he lost?
No.
Or is it the fact that Boston were a 2 seed and the joint title favorite with Milwaukee, and quickly was on a 5 seed, and Brogdon for basically the whole season averaged more points per game, more assists per game, better field goal percentage, better 3-point percentage, which, by the way, this time around, Naz Reid is the guy who has the much better shooting splits, which I think matters a lot to voters.
Sure.
And Naz has all the quickly elements, like his plus minus for the season. When he's on the court, the Wolves are plus 288. When Malik Monk was on the court for the Kings were plus 10. The Kings have been better with Monk off the court. Yeah. And I don't think every voter is going to weigh that as much as they should, but I think quite a lot will. And for all the thought about how quickly it was so disappointing and he moved into the favorite and then he lost somewhat handily. Sure, he also got 34 out of 100 first place votes. It's not like he got nothing. And even with all the flaws of his case and the starting and everything, he still gave it a decent shake. And I think that Naz has a better case than he does because of the team success element.
Yeah, that's no disagreement at all. And I would actually go, by the way, of those two choices, it was definitely because of what Brogdon did as much and what the Celtics did as a team as much as it was people. You know, if you're telling me people used it as a tiebreak because they held them up side by side, they're like, tie. Yeah. Okay. Maybe some did. But ultimately, like, for these kind of non-high, super duper high profile awards like MVP, and even to a lesser extent, Defensive Player of the Year, and to a lesser extent, Rookie of the Year, like, after you get past those three, I feel like a lot, like, voters coalesce around players for very weird reasons. And I could almost make a case that Naz Reid starting in place of an injured Carl Anthony Towns, and the awareness people have of his particular role for the Timberwolves and how important it is, and talking about him, like, you know, like, you can't miss it. Like, man, how are the Timberwolves, how have they not fallen into obscurity like the Pelicans without Brandon Ingram? Like, this is, you just lost a major piece. How in the world did you stay afloat in this one seed race? And the answer is Naz Reid stepped in and did an incredible job on both ends of the floor. And I think there's definitely a case of all of the starting is just going to raise his awareness, raise his profile, you know, raise his Q rating or whatever. And I think that has the potential to, you know, help win this award.
Yep. I'm all in on Naz, Drew, but I'm not saying that he's like a better current price. I'm not saying he's not a better current price. I really don't know what is going to happen in this award. I don't have a great grasp for how it is going to unfold, but it's quickly 2.0 now, because quickly should have won. Naz deserves to win this award, at least over Malik Monk, where, like, you watch Naz each night, as I now do religiously, and just the way that he is so incredibly efficient on offense, And the fact as well, and this needs to really seep into the conversation, he's become a really good defensive player. And I don't know how it's happened, but now he's just really good on defense. He switches 1 through 5. He's like shutting down, stonewalling Jalen Green on switches and Fred VanVleet. And then he's also protecting the rim and blocking shots. He's guarding Nikola Jokic. Like, that should play a role in Sixth Man of the Year. The fact that he is just randomly this awesome defensive player now and is also 60% true shooting and is the number two option on the one seed right now. So it is all there. The bones of his case are all there. The fact that he's on the one seed and in the hunt for the one seed, that should make his case resonate. I just don't know how much it is going to resonate with voters. And it's also, I don't know if this is a good or a bad thing, but that game against Denver on Wednesday night on national TV is so high leverage for Naz, for Chris Finch, Coach of the Year. Like, that is the spot where, and the problem is the Wolves, if Murray plays, are going to be like 8-point dogs or something. But that is a massive spot for, I think, a lot of things to potentially rise up. But, this is going to be fun. Most of the Wolves, I find, when you get to this point, like, I think that, like, most improved player, that is probably just already decided. We just don't know what the result is, and it's hard to project with certainty. But I don't think, like, the last 10 days of the season are really going to skew an award that is so abstract like that. I think Sixth Man of the Year absolutely is something that could get decided in the last 10 days because of how unique Naz Reid's case is and just how much it is going to resonate. And also, just as importantly, how much it's going to be publicized.
Yeah, we agree. If you want another talking point to add to the narrative, T-Wolves, historically great defensive team. Historically. Yeah. And this is all based on the contributions of Rudy Gobert, who has 105 defensive rating this year. Yep. Number two among the players on the Timberwolves who are contributing, Naz Reid. 106. Yeah. And they don't even spend a ton of time on court together, which is incredible. So the best lineup, the minutes played with this Timberwolves team without Towns and Naz Reid, and it's incredible. They're plus 9.3, man, over 150 minutes this year. Amazing. Yeah.
Here's the case. I'm not sure if it's going to resonate with voters, but hopefully it will. And hopefully it gets out there enough and permeates. But the Wolves are the one seed and they are better with Naz Reid on the court. The Kings are the 8 seed and they are worse with Malik Monk on the court. And I think that is kind of the crux. And there's a lot of other statistics that kind of demonstrate that. But that if that kind of permeates and is felt by voters, then I think Naz is extremely live. All right, we are done. Don't forget to check out NBCSports.com for more information to help you with your wages. Thanks to those of you watching on our NBC Sports YouTube channel. And if you're listening to us in podcast form, don't forget to rate and subscribe. Also a reminder to find all your favorite NBC Sports shows on Amazon Music. Just head to amazon.com/NBCSports. Thanks again to Trevor Sickerman for joining us. From Jay and Drew Dinsick, we'll see you next week.